That's Debatable is sponsored by MB&G. MB&G are specialists in the esoteric world of vehicle and furniture warranty insurance, delivering quite marvellous customer service, prompt claims payment, and a highly developed understanding of how to deliver these products in a way that is both compliant with the regulations and attractive to customers. Hello and welcome to That's Debatable, the weekly news podcast of the Free Speech Union. Welcome back, everyone, to That's Debatable. We're just clearing our throats before we launch into this week's episode. Ben had a bit of a tickly cough, didn't you, Ben?
Yes, it's lasted about 4 years, which is as long as my daughter has been alive for. So there does seem to be some correlation there.
Anyway, you don't smoke either. You don't smoke.
No, some days I sound like I've smoked 20 a day for decades. Anyway, there we are. Occupational hazard, I suppose, of small children.
There you go. But what a week it's been, Ben. Yeah. What a week it's been. Where are we? We're speaking together here on Monday, the 8th of April, and the new Hate Crime Act in Scotland came into force on Monday, the 1st of April. So the news cycle has just moved at a rate of knots. As reported in the Times last week, we've had nearly 1,000 new members over the last week. It's been astonishing. And we've been looking at the various proportions of people who've joined the Free Speech Union in the last week. And normally we do have, in terms of membership, we do have more men than women sign up, which isn't a surprise. We've talked a little bit about the woke gender gap, actually. It's been a bit of a topic that we've discussed. But that flipped last week, or it's flipped in the week in the run-up to the 1st of April. And we ended up with more women, particularly in Scotland, signing up. I think that we inferred from that quite a few of our new sign-ups were particularly concerned about the squashing of gender-critical views following the implementation of the Hate Crime Act. So it's been an extraordinary week, hasn't it, Ben?
Yeah, it's been a real surge. And actually, Tom, it has been, I think, a couple of weeks since we've recorded an episode, because we recorded one before Easter, didn't we? Before the act came into effect. And we were saying, well, next time we speak to you, you know, we're making ourselves hostage to fortune a bit here. We don't know what's going to happen. We were both of the view that this was going to be a complete disaster. But I don't think, in all candor, that we had anticipated that it would be as bad as it was. And I made this point in one of the dozens of TV clips that we've all been doing, speaking to GB News and Talk TV and so on about this, that if this law had been applied fairly, in inverted commas, it would have been horrendous. But the fact that we've got to the position within I think just 3 or 4 days, where the police were saying basically, oh, there's one rule if you are a member of the SNP government, if you're a government minister, there's a different rule if you're an opposition politician like Murdo Fraser, the Scottish Conservative MSP, and there's a different rule again if you're saying something we don't like, i.e. J.K. Rowling, but it would be too embarrassing for us to pursue you. And yet again, a different rule if you are an ordinary member of the public. So it has become a complete shambles. So it's not just a disastrous law, it's a disastrous law, disastrously rolled out and applied to date.
It was a PR disaster, isn't it? And the trouble with a PR disaster is that if you're trying to grapple with a new law, as Police Scotland are, trying to understand how they're going to implement it, what they're going to investigate, who they're going to arrest under this new law, then at the same time, they've got this terrible kind of PR going on. They're going to muddle the two up. Yeah. And they're going to make PR decisions in terms of how they apply the law, which is exactly what we've seen.
Yeah.
But I think it is a good opportunity to welcome all of our new members who may be listening for the first time, especially if they're listening from north of the border and are living under this new regime. And something that we ought also to mention is our new... I've been calling it the Free Speech Hotline, Ben. I think it's also... We've also called it the Hate crime hotline, which I think I felt didn't sound like the best branding to have a hate crime hotline. But in essence, it's a hotline that we've put together here at the Free Speech Union for any members to ring if they find themselves in trouble with the police about something they said under this new Hate Crime Act. And the number is, we will read it out, is 03333. So that's four threes, 03333, 403403. So just again, that's 03333, 403403. And that's on our website as well. Right on the front of our website, it's flashing. It's the first thing you see when you come to our website, that we've got the hotline sort of in lights there for anyone who gets into trouble. And we can also, for members, connect them with a top law firm in Scotland. We've got an arrangement with Levy and McRae. They're criminal lawyers in Scotland. And so if any of our members are arrested or interviewed under caution for something speech-related, we can help. Now, as always, with sort of legal support and legal help, there is an element of discretion to it, because it will absolutely depend on the facts of the case, as I think both you and I have been saying on the media.
If you're the Muppet who's been daubing graffiti outside the First Minister's home, please don't call us. If on the other hand, you've expressed a view that the vast majority of the population in Scotland and indeed the rest of the United Kingdom agree with, i.e. that you cannot change your gender, or you've expressed views indeed that people don't generally agree with, but which are not bigoted or not racist or all the rest of it, and you find yourself on the wrong side of this, please do call us and we'll be very happy to help. And the phone number is easy to remember, isn't it, Tom? Cause have I got this right? It's 043403403.
That's right. That's right. But you know me, I'm not good with numbers, Ben. So I know that in a moment of panic, I probably would utterly forget it. But it is very memorable, nevertheless. Oh, yeah. It's just me.
Commit it to memory now. My sense is, Tom, that basically this has been so horrendously ballsed up that the police are now bricking it about actually arresting anybody. And also working through this backlog where they've got, I think as of this morning, so we're speaking on the 8th of April, they've had 8,000 complaints is the figure I've seen most recently. So they're working through this huge backlog. As predicted, there have been a lot of vexatious complaints. There have been a lot of complaints also about Hamza Yousaf, who's now the most complained about person because of his speech. I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, wasn't it, in which he was sort of listing off the excessive numbers of white people as he saw it in public life in Scotland. I mean, really, really bizarre stuff. But anyway, so he's been complained about for that. And so anyway, I think the likelihood is that the police are going to have to work through all of that. And it may well be a little time now before we have somebody who's arrested, but we certainly will do. Once the furore has died down, I think that the police are going to start cracking down on this. Yeah. And that probably will be their thinking, that if it just sort of, once it's been out of the papers for a few weeks, and the heat seems to have gone out of the situation. But of course, as soon as they start arresting people for expressing completely reasonable views, it's all going to kick back off again. We will be here with our hate crime hotline and our very experienced team and law firm we've partnered up with as well. So we're ready, aren't we, for this fight?
And we're ready. For a long time. We're ready. I mean, another item, of course, with this is that these police officers are being paid overtime. So they're being paid overtime. They're doing overtime to investigate these 8,000 reports, many of which are being labelled vexatious. As you know, again, who would have thought it, Ben? Who would have thought it that this would happen? And so the police are doing this. And as we've said multiple times, there's a plenty of real crime for the police officers to be investigating. Real burglaries, real assaults, real physical things that are happening on the streets all over Britain, but obviously particularly in this instance in Scotland. And you just kind of throw your arms up in despair and think, why are we spending money and wasting time on the policing of our thoughts and of our speech? And I wonder whether there isn't a hopeful moment here as well, Ben, with the sort of bit of a disaster that's gone on with how this has been rolled out the waste of resources, the wrongly allocated resources, the uproar from the public, and the uncertainty of what this will mean, and doubtless the continuation of a sort of multi-tiered policing reality. Yeah. We've talked about an oven-ready version of this for the rest of the UK, but perhaps, hopefully, that this cake has fallen so flat, no one else will want to put the other pieces of legislation in the oven. But I might be being naive there, Ben.
Yeah, that's true. I think looking for a hopeful glimmer here, I think that's probably right. In that if you're Keir Starmer's team looking at this, perhaps this is naive, but I think it's quite difficult to be in that position where you're thinking, okay, we're planning to be in government within the next year. And this is an experience that we're keen to go through. I don't see it. And also, it's been referred to in the press as the SNP's hate crime law and so on, but it did have substantial cross-party support in the Scottish Parliament. So I think that's probably right, but that's not to say that there won't be other restrictions of freedom of speech coming our way. And actually, one of the points as well that was sort of coming up towards the end of the first week, the last few days, has been this argument that actually, well, this is a particularly egregious piece of legislation. It's particularly bad, and this stirring up offence that the act introduces for different characteristics: the threatening, abusive, or insulting, the low threshold for prosecution, the removal of the dwelling defence, and all the rest of it. So it's particularly bad, but nonetheless, in England and Wales, the rest of the United Kingdom, we also have the Communications Act, the Malicious Communications Act, the Public Order Act. So there's plenty of legislation south of the border that's of concern as well. It's just that Scotland's Hate Crime Act is particularly bad. So there's also a danger that those pieces of legislation will be reformed in a way that, should we say, is not advantageous to freedom of speech. I think that remains quite likely. I'd have thought. But in terms of having a new piece of legislation, flagship hate crime legislation copying Scotland, I think you're right, Tom. I just don't see why, looking at how disastrous this has been, a new government of whatever complexion would think, yeah, let's do that. So maybe that saved us from the worst of it.
But if there's a super majority, which is what obviously some of the papers are saying, then the new government can do what it wants, come what may. So it'll all depend on the complexion of the new House of Commons and, where we land in people are thinking November, I think, for the general election or sometime around that. We don't know, obviously, but we shall see.
We're making lots of predictions today, Tom. We are, again, making ourselves hostages to fortune.
It's a fool's game making predictions about anything, particularly in politics. My goodness me. But we do believe in freedom of speech, though, so we're allowed to make predictions and then fall flat on our face, and that's okay.
We are. And we promise not to delete previous episodes when our predictions are previous.
Yeah, when they don't come true. Yeah,
so if in the first month of a Labour government we have a new hate crime act for the rest of the United Kingdom, we will be resisting the urge to go back through our back catalogue and deleting this episode.
It could never have happened.
What they have said, though, is that they do intend to bring back non-crime hate incident reporting of various kinds, and particularly in the context of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism as well. So that whole house of horrors, it seems to be on its way back. So,
let's see. Like a zombie that won't die in a film.
Yeah.
But we will keep everyone posted as the hate crime truck rumbles forward in Scotland. And as I say, we're here. We've got everything. Everyone here at Free Speech Union HQ is equipped to help to the best we possibly can. But we should move on to talk about something that's kind of fallen down the news a little bit. We released this report. The Free Speech Union released this report. It was a good 2 weeks ago now. And the report was written by me, actually, but with a lot of help from my colleagues, obviously, and Toby. And
I'm going to turn my mic off now, Tom, so I'm not going to be needed for the next 15 minutes. So you rattle through it. It's all good stuff. Everyone pays. It's really interesting, genuinely.
You are key in all the numbers, Ben. I know you love numbers.
Yeah. Go on. Sorry, Tom. I've thrown you off. Go on. Back to it.
Don't worry. It's a report called the EDI tax, how equity, diversity and inclusion is hobbling British businesses. And I know that EDI, equity, diversity and inclusion, probably fills everyone with even more horror, or at least as much horror as things like NCHI and other of these free speech union acronyms that have kind of come to the fore. But what we did was we decided, having seen so much come into our casework related to equity, diversity, inclusion, and actually environmental training, we decided that we were going to do a specific piece of research, a specific piece of work to look at how this training is landing across the UK, across industries, across size of employer. We took a sample of 800 part-time or full-time employees who had gone through this training. So obviously we had to run our survey through more people than that, because not everyone has gone through it. So we actually got quite an interesting initial statistic that it's about two-thirds of employers or employees have gone through EDI or climate training of some shape or form, either at a current employer or at a former employer. And we used third-party consumer panels to do this survey and to collect this sample of employees, because then we could do this at arm's length. And first of all, we didn't have to kind of create the machinery to do the sampling and make sure it was reasonable. But also it was at arm's length. We weren't, you know, these weren't our members, though some of them doubtless were. But they weren't our members. They weren't particularly in free speech world. They were just on a consumer panel. And this would have been one of the surveys that crossed their desk, having signed up to those panels. But what we found was really quite, we were shocked, but we weren't shocked, I think is probably the best way to put it. But I will say this, and I'll go through the results in a moment. First of all, the free speech union staff were given a heads up on these results. And we had all the free speech union staff in a room together. And Ben, I don't know if you remember, but when we went through the headline results, there was an audible gasp in the room.
Yes, there was. Yeah.
And that audible gasp came from people who see this, like you, who see the free speech troubles of the United Kingdom every day, and people who are dealing with all sorts of versions of this problem every day. And yet there was an audible gasp in the room when we just saw the size of the problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, just to go through some of these, first of all, 62% of those we surveyed said that they had to conceal what they really think about the training they've received, including, shockingly, 22% who have been compelled to say things that they don't really believe. 22% have been compelled to say things that they don't really believe. And by the way, that rises to 31% among Black and Asian respondents. So self-censorship, Ben, is just rife. Just in that first headline result.
I'll just chip in to say, this is your segment, Tom. Anecdotally, I've had two emails from two different people just this morning, Monday morning, who are in a situation where they're having training of some sort that's politically partisan and completely bonkers, they're needing assistance with it. So, yeah, it's interesting to have my impression, my experience of how prevalent this is confirmed by polling. Anyway, right, back to you.
No, I mean, I will whip quickly through just the headlines, because they're kind of shocking. That 62% was the first one. 45% said that their EDI or climate training conflicted with their personal, religious or political views, what we collectively called their values. 36% have witnessed staff being penalized in some way by their current employer because they challenged the training. That includes 12% who've witnessed staff being fired for challenging the training. 31% have left a former employer at some point earlier in their career because of that employer's endorsement of woke ideology, if you will. That was also higher amongst minority groups. It was 43% for Black, 46% for Asian, 46% for LGBT.
And Tom, is the reason for that, I mean, likely to be that those groups are more likely to be religious and therefore...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. So we were able to collect demographic information on all of those people. We asked each respondent about their ethnic group, about their religious belief, about their political beliefs. So we could absolutely kind of splice the data together. And we did indeed find that when you came to sort of religious people, they were very much higher up the league table of groups who had found that this training conflicted with their values. And so when you actually try and do too much intersectionality, hateful word, sorry about that, Ben, when you try and look at too many sort of subgroups of subgroups, it becomes less statistically credible. So a good example would be if we had a few people who were from the Hindu religion, but we weren't able to draw too many credible results from that specific religion because there weren't enough in our sample. However, we were able to draw credible results for those with a Christian background or a Muslim background because there were enough in our sample. And both of those showed that they were finding this training to conflict with their personal values or their religious values quite to a higher degree than the average. And that was credible, you know, across pretty much every single minority group. Then we had 9% had such a negative view of the EDI and climate training that they said they might leave an employer in the future who insisted on it. There's a bit of a difference there between those who said they would in the future and those who said they had at some point in the past. 31% had done so in the past, 9% said they would in the future. It could be perhaps that training is getting a little bit better, and so there's a smaller number who are worried about needing to leave in the future when there was some very authoritarian training, say back in 2020, 2021. But we weren't entirely sure about that. But nevertheless, the headline figures were pretty shocking in and of themselves. Now, one thing we also cross-referenced with was whether the employers were looking for some sort of accreditation, like Carbon Literate Organization, B Corp, or signatories of the Race at Work Charter. And it turned out that nearly half, so 44% of employees, said that their employer had or was seeking at least one type of EDI or climate accreditation. And what we found then was that those employers were far more likely to be among those that had fired employees or penalized them in any way for challenging the training. So again, we are not surprised by that, but it was really interesting to see it turn up in the data that they were significantly more likely, if they're on that path towards a Stonewall Diversity Champion or a B Corp or Race at Work Charter, they were far more likely to penalize their employees. And it, slightly related to that, we found that 2/3 of employees, 66%, had concepts from EDI and climate training incorporated into their annual performance goals. That means pay and rations for these people, for these employees who are going to these courses, EDI and climate courses, are then having pay and rations, their promotions, their progress at work linked back to this training. So, I think, Ben, that's a lot of stats I've just thrown out there. And I don't want to kind of give any listeners number blindness, if that's not mixing up my senses. That's a lot of stats. I think what I took away from it is none of the stats were surprising in directionally. The magnitude of the stats was fairly shocking, I think.
Yeah.
That it was just this number of people who are now going through this and where it's authoritarian are really struggling under it and suffering under it. So I thought that was quite interesting in and of itself.
Have we described this using the acronym EDICT? because if not, we've missed.
We did, yeah. I haven't actually made that connection, Ben. Having spent months on this work and come up with the acronym EDIC training, I hadn't turned it into EDICT, which I think is quite a smart acronym, right. Actually.
That's an original coinage, then, that I'm claiming credit for.
Go for it, yeah. Yeah.
One of the points that just struck me while you were talking, and obviously these are all the things that you've got to cope with if you've got a job. But to take an example, particularly this is prevalent in academia, when you're applying for a job, you are very likely now to have to submit a sort of, it's a confessional style document almost of, one page as part of your application on your commitment to equality, diversity, and inclusion, or equity, as is increasingly the case. And one positive development that came about, I think it was last month. Yes, it was. It was towards the end of March. This was the consultation launched by the Office for Students on the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act that is coming into effect later this year. And one of the points in that guidance was that, well, there's quite a lot actually that's worth talking about, and I'm sure we did at the time. But those kind of documents, requiring those kind of documents as part of job applications, would not be acceptable under the Act, that it would conflict with academic freedom. And obviously, we welcome that. But yeah, I mean, when you get your foot in, I mean, assuming you survive that process of applying for jobs, to then have this situation where you're going through this kind of training, in inverted commas, I mean, it would be like having, for instance, a Catholic employer who insisted that you underwent training on transubstantiation, in which the training was not saying this is what Catholics believe, this is what Protestants believe, but in which the training was saying the bread and the wine literally become the body and blood of Christ. Or to work for an employer who said, this is my view about how to reduce the deficit. This is the only correct way. You know, it would just be completely, obviously it would be a completely bizarre thing for an employer to insist that their employees undergo training on their religious beliefs in a confessional style or on their political beliefs. And yet when it comes to equality, diversity, inclusion, and now climate as well, employers do just seem to have this assumption that, oh, well, you know, all decent people must think this. And this isn't contentious. Yeah. And we see this all the time.
Well, and I think that the way it's being locked into organizations is very interesting. It's being locked in by these accreditation schemes that we've done a lot of work on.
Yes.
Because we've seen them crop up a lot. So that was why we were on the front foot there to ask questions about, you know, when we designed this piece of research, we deliberately asked questions about carbon literate organizations and B Corps and such like. But, you know, when I really mean lock in, because if you remember from the B Corp work we did, we talked about mission lock, where the articles of association of a company have to be changed to reflect that direction and that, in essence, that new accreditation that the company has gained. You know, and similarly, if they become a carbon literate organization, it's quite a public relations disaster to lose it down the track. So once you have it as an organization, you absolutely don't want to lose it. And actually, a drum is banged by employers that they've now got that accreditation. So it's very obvious if they do lose it, and it causes all sorts of difficulties for the directors trying to navigate through that. Then you've got, at the more micro level, you've got these sort of performance development goals to which pay and rations are connected. So that's tangled up. And then one element we've also talked about that we didn't explicitly go into in this piece of research was for the individuals. Again, you may have an open-minded employer who may give you really good training on what diversity and inclusion originally was supposed to mean, you know, inclusivity of everybody, of all kinds of people, and diversity of thought. But if you're a professional, you'll also have your professional regulator rolling out some sort of D&I requirement, and that may not be open-minded at all. So you've kind of got two potential clubs coming at you in this world, one from your employer and the other from a professional regulator. So you've got these layers now of authoritarianism that sort of, or not always necessarily authoritarian, but layers of this EDI reality that are locking you in and constraining your world and making the box in which you operate more and more narrow. So, you know, I think it really came out in this piece of work that we're battling against them.
Yeah.
And just two additional things that we were very lucky, because when we published this briefing paper, which you can find on the website, and we'll put a link in to it in today's show notes, there was a report by the Inclusion at Work panel published the same week. It had originally been commissioned by the UK's Minister for Women and Equalities, Kemi Badenoch. And that piece of research involved interviews with 100 people. They represented 55 organisations. And that report noted a lack of accessible, plain language, robust data on the efficacy of diversity and inclusion interventions, and in fact, a lack of evidence that these interventions were effective in achieving their objectives. One of the things that really struck me in that report, Ben, was that they challenged this idea that all of society's problems are somehow decanted into every employer, whatever business they might be in, whatever part of the country they might be in, and that that was just a complete fallacy. You know, the social problems of UK PLC, for want of a better phrase, are not necessarily replicated across all employers at all. And so again, it's this cardboard cutout way of looking at the world. And that report sort of is really interesting because it also proposes an alternative way of doing diversity and inclusion. We have to come to terms with the fact I don't think we're ever going to lose this idea of diversity and inclusion now, but then we have to do it in a better way. And measuring, collecting the data, actually seeing if this is effective is sort of criteria number one in that new report from Kemi Badenoch. So I thought that was a really sort of good thing that came out the same week. And the second thing is a bit more of a dated piece of work going back to December 2020. And this again was the government. Their behavioral insights team came to a very similar conclusion in its review of unconscious bias training. And there was a written ministerial statement that came out with that study. And it noted the following, quote, despite a growing diversity training industry and increased adoption of unconscious bias programs, a strong body of evidence has emerged that shows that such training has no sustained impact on behavior and may even be counterproductive. So, you know, our study is by no means the first. It will by no means be the last, but hopefully it will be an important kind of brick in the wall that shows the problem that we have, and that it's just not on for companies and for employers to continue with this cardboard cutout approach to diversity, inclusion, equity, environmental, which politicizes the workplace, treats minority groups in a way that makes them feel even more alienated, and really doesn't have the outcome that employers want anyway. So there is and has to be a better way of doing it, which is where we kind of leave the report. We point people towards the Kemi Badenoch report, or the report that was written for Kemi Badenoch. And that's another good link in there that people can go and have a read of. But the last observation I would make, of course, is something we've spoken about again and again, Ben, which is, of course, the amount of money that's being spent on this just grows exponentially. And the taxpayers' allowance, that's me doing my tax return. The Taxpayers' Alliance discovered, you know, that's being doubled just in local authorities. The amount has doubled between 2020-21 and 2022-23. While at the same time, Ben, in the same period, 10 councils have declared bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So they're doubling the amount they spend on this stuff.
this
and declaring bankruptcy.
This is what I've been. If I can reclaim the mic for a moment, the thing I've been chomping the bit to say is that the argument for diversity in boardrooms, for example, was that you would get diversity of thought and that that would add value and generate profit ultimately. And instead, we've now got to the point where we can't have diversity of thought because we've got to have diversity. And so the whole thing has been inverted, flipped upside down. And that's the position now that, that British businesses have got themselves into. And you're right to point to these reports, these ministerial statements that have been made from time to time, and so on. These howls into the wind by government and by ministers. It's just that none of them then seem to bear any resemblance to what's actually going on, even in the civil service, much less in the private sector, is frustrating. Shall we say?
Well, your point about groupthink, I've also kind of, for some reason, I seem to have, and I enjoyed this role that I've found. It's kind of my role of getting involved in things like the consultations on equity, diversity, inclusion of our various regulators and things like that.
Yeah.
I think it's because I kind of just put my hand up and have ended up getting heavily involved in a lot of these consultations. And once you've done one, you kind of realize the themes that come up.
Yes,
you know, in a consultation to a medical regulator, are exactly the same themes that come up in a consultation to a financial regulator. Again, and the one of them is groupthink.
Yeah.
The each one of these consultations says, we in our profession, we want to eliminate or minimize groupthink. That's why we're doing this. That's why diversity is great. It's just good business. All of the normal kind of sloganeering. Pretty empty slogans, to be honest, because groupthink is what these things embed.
Yeah.
They absolutely embed groupthink. It doesn't need to be that way, but that's the way it is. That's the reality we're living in right now with the organizations that are providing this diversity training, with the way that employers are expecting their third parties to deliver the training, and the way the activist employees are very carefully policing what this means, so that if anyone goes off course and allows for diversity of thought, the senior leaders are being terrified. And you know, I just think we have to wrestle this stuff out of the hands of HR departments. We need leaders and directors in businesses who will say, no, enough, we're done with this in this way. We're going to do it in that way. We're going to go with this organization that actually looks at things in a number of different and alternative ways from, you know, the trans activists or whatever it might be. And that's another point that really comes out of the piece of work we did with our sampling, is that the entrepreneurial people, the people who may still be part-time employees, but also own their own business, and probably are looking to make that their full-time job, their own business, they're the most against this. They're the most likely to have left somewhere because of the sort of wokiness of it and the social justice elements of it that are thrust down their throat. So our entrepreneurs, maybe that's a route out of that. Good old, instead of a nation of shopkeepers, we become a nation of entrepreneurs. And then we can build our businesses the way we want to and not be constrained by this stuff. Doesn't help the public sector, though.
Well,
that's a solution for the private sector.
Speak for England, Tom, because you can certainly talk for Britain. Can I nudge it along? Because I'd love to give an example. I'd love to give an example of where this leads us to, because it's a brilliant report, and it captures so much that we see day to day that people are really struggling with. And I thought it all comes together in a situation like that at the Office for National Statistics, doesn't it? Where, so again, we're not talking about private business, but it's all a muchness, I'm afraid, when it comes to these issues. And this was the revelation in the Sunday Telegraph that employees, I mean, primarily we're going to be talking about female employees here, can be disciplined or be on the receiving end of grievance procedures if they object to male colleagues who are transitioning using female toilets. And these documents have been leaked to the Sunday Telegraph. And I have to say, at the Free Speech Union, pretty regularly, we get people coming forward and saying, look, I work for such and such an organization, or I'm in such and such a business, and this is what the HR policy says. It's often NHS trusts. We get lots of material from NHS trusts that are doing things like this, that are threatening staff if they don't use the, in inverted commas, right pronouns and so on. And I think, Tom, that the point that emerges from your report and this collapse of diversity of thought, and the cardboard sort of cutout version of an EDI policy, you know, this is what it leads to, isn't it? Where these decisions are being made in rooms where there's nobody saying, well, hang on a minute, that's insane. Or hang on a minute, most of the population, most of the public that we serve, most of our staff, if they're at all representative, will hold gender-critical views. Actually, I was told off slightly by Julia Hartley-Brewer the other day, because I think I said...
she loves you!
Well, I think I said something like, for people who believe in biological reality, and she quite rightly cut across me and said, no, I don't believe in it, I know it, which I think was right. So,
she also forced you to say sex shop rather than adult shop, which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah, I was speaking euphemistically. This was the...
he wouldn't let you.
No, the hate crime reporting shop that's been set up in a Glasgow sex shop. So we spoke about this last time, didn't we? So you can go in and dob in your husband or your wife or whatever, if they call you a grumpy old such and such.
I loved her all the more for making you say that.
I know. And I euphemistically, I think I was speaking to her at about midday. And so I used the formula adult shop, and she said, no, sex shop. And I was, this was an example of compelled speech, I suppose, because I then had to say sex shop live on air.
Well, you were group thinking that one, I'm afraid. And she was right.
Anyway, gosh, what were we talking about, Tom? I've gone completely off piste.
Well, you were essentially saying that, you know, we are seeing this sort of one-sided implementation of EDI in the NHS specifically, particularly in our work, but also here in the Office for National Statistics, where this leaked, as reported, it was in the Sunday Telegraph, I think. Yeah, it was this cache of documents was leaked that was very one-sided, actually threatening kind of gender-critical employees that they might be put through a disciplinary procedure if they started raising concerns about trans employees using women's spaces, women's toilets and such like. So, but what really struck me there is the sort of, the element of, you know, this is the Office for National Statistics, and they got into all sorts of trouble about the census data when it turned out that they'd said that, I think it was 0.5% of the population over 16 identified as trans. And a lot of people kind of looked at that and went, that sounds a little high. And actually there was an investigation into that led by the Office for Statistics Regulation. And they said that the ONS should have done more to communicate inherent uncertainties relating to the data, specifically in relating to that element of the census data, and that the wording of the question hadn't been as clear as it should have been, particularly for people who don't have English as a first language. But what it also showed up, I think, Ben, is this whole area of data, which is a free expression issue. We need to have data to make policy decisions, to make resource allocation decisions. And there was another article this week written by Neil O'Brien, who is the Conservative MP for Harborough. Mm. And he wrote an article, again, talking about the ONS not breaking down population by nationality in the way that it used to. So particularly in relation to migration, it's become much more difficult to look at the economic effects of different types of migration. Officials have stopped publishing the data needed. And what's interesting is not just the Office for National Statistics, the Department for Education used to publish data that meant that you could analyze the earnings of graduates by which university and course they had graduated from. HM Revenue and Customs used to publish annual data on how much tax people of different nationalities paid, but they stopped doing that. The Department for Work and Pensions used to publish data on welfare claims by nationality. but it stopped doing that. The Ministry of Justice does publish the nationalities of current prisoners, but won't provide further analysis, such as how many of them are repeat offenders. So my point here isn't to get into a discussion about immigration, but into a discussion about how we have a discussion about immigration. If open data and clear data and consistent data is no longer being published, it means the discussion that may well need to happen doesn't, because these departments don't trust us to have the discussions, Ben. That seems to be what's happening underneath this. We're not trusted to have open discussions with open data on important political subjects because we're dreadful people.
Well, Tom, I always suspected that about you, but now that you're admitting it. No, you're right.
I'm going to the sex shop all the time.
Sorry, I'm being very waspish today, Tom. It's very unfair. That's right. It's just this fear that the British public are a seething mass of bigots, and that information like that is going to be empowering. It's just complete nonsense. And we saw this as well, to go back again to Scotland, if I may, just once more, in the marketing around the Hate Crime Act and what Police Scotland was saying, that hate is particularly prevalent. Was it among 18 to 30-year-old men from deprived communities? Mm. It was something like that, wasn't it? I'm not reading that off my notes. That may not be verbatim, but it was something to that effect. It is this terrible and completely unfounded fear that the public just cannot be trusted and that we're all racists and fruitcakes or whatever. It's maddening. And that, I think, as you've just said, all of those consequences then that ripple through our politics, through our political system, through the kind of debates we can have. It just makes it impossible. And I think particularly with immigration, in the last 15 years, there's been this incredibly facile discussion about whether a phenomenon called immigration is good or bad. And actually, that's a completely meaningless question without the kind of granular detail that the ONS ought to be publishing. It's really impossible to have an informed conversation about it, about the different types of migration, for instance, about national origin, about the different courses that people's lives and different groups they're in, how that affects it and what the outcomes are for different groups. And all those things are just seem to now be in the views of the civil service and the quangocracy to be beyond the pale. And I think that's just setting us up for yet another disaster. Politically and for freedom of speech and so on. I thought the article was very welcome. I'd seen that Neil O'Brien had been tweeting about some of this stuff as well a few weeks ago. So I'm glad that he's got a larger audience to raise these concerns. I think it's a serious problem.
It is. But we're running out of time, Ben. We did have another item slated, but I wonder whether we have time to go into it.
We'll kick that for next week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shall we mention finally, though, just before we leave our listeners for another week, that we do have events, lots of events coming up. Jan McVarish, our events director, is, as ever, putting together a delectable buffet of events that's coming up over the next 60 days, 90 days. Sorry, Ben, I meant that. I know. Does that sound
bad? It was a phrase I didn't expect to hear. Tom, but it is right to say that we are putting together some excellent events, as always.
I mean, the one that jumped out at me was Wednesday, the 1st of May, is going to be in Edinburgh. And no surprise, I imagine, for our listeners, we're going to have a speakeasy in Edinburgh, 30 days of hate crime law. And included amongst our speakers are Murdo Fraser, who we talked about a lot on this episode and on previous episodes. Yep. He's also on our Scottish Advisory Council. And David McKee, who is a senior partner in the law firm Levy McRae. That is the law firm with whom we have an arrangement to support our members who may find themselves in trouble following the new Hate Crime Act. And then we have this fellow called Toby Young, Ben.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know anything about Toby?
Yeah, I've heard of him. I'm familiar.
I've heard of him. He's going to be there as well. So 30 days of the hate crime law. That's a great one to go. But I mean, we have an events page on our website. So do visit that events page. Have a look at what's coming up. And just like a buffet, with an empty plate, you'll come back to your table satisfied and full. That's where we are. But anything else to add, Ben?
No, I don't think so. Thank you very much for listening, particularly if it's your first time listening to the podcast, and welcome to the FSU if you are a new member of ours. Busy time.
Have a great week, everyone, and we will speak next time.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.